Hello and welcome again to Ecosystemic Futures, and now season seven. Season seven is going to be dedicated to strength in systems, fielding America's next 250 years. Marco, Vic, as you know, we're celebrating America's 250th, and with this season, we're going to be looking forward to the next 250 years and what innovation, what technology will drive what we experience in the next couple of centuries. So I'm Diane Finkhausen, and I'm joined by my podcast partners, Marco Annunziata and Vikram Shyam. As America marks its 250th year, we're examining the innovation systems that will define the next 250, as I mentioned. Over six seasons behind us, spanning over 118 episodes, plus some webinars, and we've explored ecosystemic thinking with over 200 of the world's leading innovators and changemakers across the domains of defense, space, healthcare, energy, AI, and so much more. Season seven focuses on the intersection of rapid fielding of technologies, ecosystem orchestration, and complex systems thinking, the capabilities that are going to deliver through strength. We're going to hear from space technology pioneers, defense innovation practitioners, AI governance experts, and civil society scholars. But before we look ahead, let's revisit the journey that brought us here. Six seasons of conversations that have revealed patterns, provocations, and principles, and if we're honest, paradigm shifts that are more relevant now, honestly, than ever. Today, we won't find or try to provide definitive answers. Instead, we're going to surface the critical questions that we're going to tee up throughout the year ahead. Marco and Vic, welcome back. Thanks for joining again. For our listeners that are just plugging in, why don't you provide a little bit of background on each of yourselves? Why don't we start with you, Marco?
Thanks, Diane. Yes, so for those who've missed the past 250 years, I'm Marco Annunziata. I'm an economist. My expertise really is in economics and technology and innovation. My background, I've done policy, I've done finance, I've done tech, and I've done industry. I was the chief economist at General Electric. So my passion really is bringing together issues of economics, geopolitics, and innovation.
Amazing, Vic.
Hard to follow that, but I'm a futurist and have worked for the last 10 to 15 years on strategy, and I'm a big fan of looking at nature and figuring out how to apply nature to human systems, and been doing that in a personal capacity as well as for NASA.
Gents, thank you so much. I'm really excited to dive into this next season with you both. I think it's going to be an exciting one. We have a great community. And there's a lot of incredible innovation out there, technology development, and changes in the world around us. So before we dive in, let's just again acknowledge the context of what's ahead of us. So as we look forward to the next 250 years for America, we're entering a period of heightened geopolitical competition, tensions around the world, conflicts around the world. Emerging domains like space and AI are literally reshaping the global landscape. Quantum is coming online. Yet our conversations over six seasons have revealed something that I find inspirational and hopeful. Interconnected economic ecosystems can actually act as stabilizing forces, and necessarily so in this environment. Basically, the raising cost of conflict and creating incentives for cooperation amid strategic conversation, we need to be very thoughtful, very intentional about how all these convergences connect and shape the fabric of society, industry, and policy. So for us, really, the overarching question for season seven becomes, can we design ecosystems in space, in AI, in defense innovation, that are robust enough to deliver peace through strength, resilient enough to withstand disruption, and equitable enough to maintain social cohesion? We aren't going to answer anything definitively today. Instead, we're going to tee up the critical questions that we'll explore throughout season seven. So really, this session today is really setting up a whole year of what we know will be more brilliant conversations 6 years ago when we launched the podcast, ecosystem was still primarily a biological term. So today it's fundamental to how we think about innovation, national security, and economic competitiveness. But what have we actually learned? I know the three of us have wrestled with that a lot. More importantly, what questions remain unanswered? And we're going to be relying on our guests this year to help us wrestle with that. Marco, over to you. Let's jump in. In our very first episode of this entire kind of series, you talked about our understanding of how ecosystems has become much more dynamic, complex, and nuanced. Compared to 15 years ago, you said, we now understand that these are not just networks of firms, but dynamic systems with feedback loops, emergent properties, and self-organizing capabilities, and in fact, self-healing capabilities. Now, six seasons later, as we enter season seven, focused on fielding systems for America's next 250 years, how has ecosystemic thinking evolved even further? What have we learned about the pace and nature of these feedback loops in defense and space context, industry, policy, society? Over to you, Marco.
Thanks. Oh, lots of thoughts. Thanks, Diane. And I'll give you a few thoughts and then I'll follow up actually by bringing Vic into the conversation because I have a related question for him. But so first of all, let me add that it's actually remarkable, as you pointed out at the beginning, Diane, we're celebrating the first 250 years of the U.S. as a country. We're looking forward to the next 250 years. And it happens at a time when there is so much going on that this really does feel like a turning point, right? We're facing geopolitical turmoil, social and cultural turmoil within a number of countries, especially in the West, economic turmoil across a range of issues, and of course, technological disruption at an accelerating pace. So it really does feel like this is one of the times when, perhaps coincidentally, it does make sense to ask what is changing and how are the next 250 years going to be different from now? Now, the issue of ecosystems, as you mentioned, Diane, is crucial to this because when I looked at this with my economist hat on, what I saw is 20 years ago, we were going through a booming phase of globalization. The global economy was getting more complex, more interconnected, but we were thinking of it literally more in terms of just companies and countries building bridges and connection lines with each other, trading more with each other, building global supply chains. We were thinking about it, I think, in a very mechanical way, the interconnections that were being created, and we were very excited about the efficiency that this was generating. And so lower costs, stronger economic growth, higher standards of living. Fast forward 15, 20 years ago to now, I think more recently, we've learned a lot. We've learned that these more complex and interconnected systems have dynamics of their own, which are very, very different from the old economies. Diane, you mentioned the emergent properties, the resilience, self-organizing. You can see it in the economy. I'll give you and our listeners just one example, which I think is very powerful. Over the past few years, we've seen a resurgence of protectionism. So more and more barriers thrown up to global trade. And of course, what we've seen last year with Liberation Day and the strong emphasis this U.S. administration has put on tariffs has exacerbated this. Now, the old thinking had created panic. We all thought, well, not me, I'll call myself out. I was right. But most economists thought this is going to be a disaster. Most market participants in financial markets thought this is going to be a disaster. It's going to plunge the economy potentially into a global recession. Now, not only did this not happen, and partly is because actually tariffs have not gone up as much as was threatened. But not only have we not gone into a recession, the global economy is doing very well. The U.S. economy is going very well. And I think what is surprising about this is that we are seeing ecosystems at work. We're seeing companies and networks of companies reacting organically to an environment which is being disrupted, to an environment which is subject to a lot more uncertainty, but organically, these systems are adapting and reacting, and you can see it in profitability, you can see it in economic growth. This is not to dismiss the problems and risks, but what we are seeing is a level of resilience of the economic system which has surprised most observers, which is very poorly understood, and which I think you can only analyze through the lenses of ecosystems and systems thinking. And here's where I wanted to just bring Vic into the conversation immediately, because Vic, you were pointing out at the beginning, in introducing yourself, that you've always been passionate about looking at nature and learning from nature and how it maps into our own systems. And you think about what we saw over the past seasons. I remember that in season one, our friend Ed Powell made a very profound observation. He was thinking about warfare and technology and said, the best thinking today about warfare focuses on systems. We've continually made platforms marginally better, but when you start thinking about these weapons as systems and how they interact with other systems, then you get geometric increases in capability. Now, he was talking about weapon systems and warfare because, like me, Ed is a little bit... we are too much fans of war movies, but it applies to other areas as well. So, and it does echo something which is embedded in nature. So, Vic, from your perspective, what does system thinking actually mean? Because it's very used as an expression, perhaps not very well understood. And how do you see it fitting into the analysis we've developed over this series? And the this is where I wanted to bring Vic immediately into the conversation, because Vic, when you were introducing yourself at the beginning, you stressed that you're passionate about learning from nature and seeing how nature systems themselves are mapped into what we do. So I remember in season one, our friend Ed Powell made a very profound observation about warfare and technology. He said, the best thinking today about warfare focuses on systems. We've continually made platforms marginally better, but when you start thinking about these weapons as systems and how they interact with other systems, then you get geometric increases in capability. Now, Ed is a warmonger like myself. We watch too many movies, but yeah. This applies outside warfare, outside weapon systems as well. So from your perspective, what is systems thinking and how does it apply to ecosystems and to the whole themes we've been developing over our seasons?
Sure. Yeah, that's a very complex question, I guess, just like I guess ecosystems are. But to your point, going back a few steps where you were talking about the resilience of the economic system and how a lot of the collapse that was predicted maybe was buffered. And I think one of the things we talked about before was the existing rules or norms that exist within societies that keep things connected, that almost provide a buffering solution. And that goes towards a property of systems, which is that they're emergent. So not everything at the highest level can be predicted, and it's not always like a sum of the parts. So there's properties. If, for example, we assume that we have properly identified what is best for the individuals in the system, like the humans, the organizations, the artificial institutions we have created, and we're able to figure out how to measure what is beneficial for their health, there's a tendency, perhaps, at the larger level where these things are connected, if they're connected properly, orchestrated in the appropriate manner and set up in a way that there are feedback loops set up such that things are being sourced from some place that's accessible, sustainable, local. It's using processes that are perhaps, you know, repeatable, hierarchical, recyclable. So once you set up these kinds of things at the smallest or the lowest level, you start to get properties of natural ecosystems that are successful, that have weathered things like extinction events. So you think about rainforests, so you think about our ancestors that burrowed deep underground and when the asteroid impact hit and wiped out a large portion of the planet. why is it that our ancestors survived? There's a lot of things to do with that. One of them is being able to scatter, being diverse, keeping a historical context. So another part of successful systems is being able to learn from mistakes. And that ties to connectivity. So a lot of one of the differences, I think, that we're seeing today versus what's happened before is that there's a lot of fractures in our fundamental connection at the human level. Things like children playing outside together, or we're seeing these generational impacts from loneliness. We're seeing a disconnect between the proliferation of technological growth versus the education system and people's familiarity with technology kind of diminishing. And so all of these things are pointing towards a lack of cohesion at that fundamental level. In addition to that, the social structures that keep us connected, such as religious organizations or the so-called touch industries, or you talk about hair salons or bars where people typically tended to mingle, those kinds of institutions are seeing a decline. And so in society, I know you're talking about war and how things get together, but on the other side of it, in order to make sure that you have peace, you almost need these buffering impacts of society where things are together. And one of the emergent properties of globalization and interconnectedness is perhaps a decline of the local institutions that kept people together. Because once you start to compare cultures and compare conflicting ideas, people start to question the validity of those. And so as those things are declining, like religion, the alternative institutions like secular support systems for whether it is therapy or whether it is how to congregate around children or other kinds of special interest activities, those have not sprung up at a sufficient rate to keep up with the decline of those other systems. So anyway, there's a whole list of topics here, but I think in terms of the systems thinking, the point is going back to how do we create the right connections between the nodes in the system? How do we assign the appropriate values to those nodes? And how do we measure the outcomes? What does it mean for an ecosystem to be healthy? We measure efficiency and GDP, but for something that's resilient, you may not want efficiency. You may want resilience and redundancy to be able to weather severe impacts. Hopefully that gets to some of that. I'm not sure what your thoughts are.
It does. It actually brings up, Diane, if I can keep going on this for a second, but it brings up something very interesting, because you've mentioned the issue of what we measure and measuring efficiency in GDP and GDP growth versus measuring resilience. And we've seen and suffered this because over the boom of globalization, we were focused almost single-mindedly on efficiency. And then all of a sudden, we realized that we had a system that was tremendously fragile. So anything happens, a trade war, a geopolitical shock, a pandemic, the system broke down. We've seen it break down with a sudden collapse in global growth, a sudden collapse in trade, in incomes, in poverty reduction. And that there is a powerful lesson there, because if you measure efficiency at the end of that collapse, say, well, the system actually wasn't as efficient as we thought, because, and borrowing from what you were saying, Vic, the conclusion has to be because we were not applying system thinking. We were analyzing this system in a much more simplified and linear way, and so we missed the interconnections. And there is something else that I wanted us to focus a bit more on in what you were saying, Vic. It has to do with the war and peace theme, but it has a lot to do with technology. So you are talking about the extent to which some of the social glue that keeps us together is being disconnected, is being ripped apart. And I think one question that we will try to address over the course of season 7 is, to what extent do ecosystems provide an alternative glue, a sort of self-stabilizing element. I've mentioned the resilience of the global economy, but let me make another example, which is very current. So from a geopolitical perspective, we are all looking at the situation now, and we are witnessing an increased risk of conflicts all over the place. We have Russia-Ukraine, we have tensions in the Middle East, tensions in Latin America, tensions around Taiwan with China. So it feels like the risk of war has escalated dramatically. This after a period where, especially in some areas like the European Union, the thinking was, well, if we get the economies to trade with each other, that will reduce the incentives for war. We're going to have peace through economic integration. Then we've seen that that works only up to a point, and we've gone recently to the other extreme of fearing that, well, now we have isolationism, protectionism, nationalism, so it's all going to break down and it's going to maximize the chances of war. On the other hand, when I look at what is happening, what's remarkable is how little disruption is happening in terms of war, fingers crossed, right? And again, we have Russia-Ukraine. We've had, frankly, a little bit ridiculous positions from European leaders coming out and saying, oh, we have to get ready for war. It's going to be 1939 all over again. But no, the conflict, terrible as it is, has remained contained. China has not made a move on Taiwan yet. The intervention of the U.S. in Venezuela was very targeted and very limited. Even in the Middle East, what we've seen is terrible, but it hasn't exploded in a broader conflagration. So this, to me, raises the question, are we seeing a situation where, in fact, the ecosystems, especially, I look at them especially on the economic side, and it makes me think perhaps these economic ecosystems that have been created are playing a stabilizing role. I mean, the European Union screams about Russia. They're still buying Russian energy. They're still trading. We scream about China. We're still trading with China. We've had an explosion in protectionism, but more recently we've seen India striking a trade deal with the European Union instead of escalating a rhetoric against the United States when the United States were being very aggressive. And then the United States looks around and says, hey, we're missing an important market. Maybe we should go back and talk to India more. So question number one, and then I'd love for you, Diane, and Vic to jump in, but will we explore the issue of whether ecosystems can play a stabilizing role? And number two, what do we think about the opposite risk, which is the degree to which technology instead might be breaking up some of these connections the way that Vic was indicating?
Yeah, I think This is a great exploration, and Beck, I'd love your thoughts on this. But in my thinking, you know, whether it's countries or companies or individuals within the context of society, we're talking about and thinking about systems of systems, right? And to Vic's earlier point, that we're seeing, I think, a really organic adaptation of the individual nodes within these systems. So think of the increase in protectionism as the nodes, right? The country nodes within these systems as kind of strengthening the optimization of their own self-interest within the context of the greater geopolitical system, right? Whereas in globalism, as we were leaning into globalism, some of those self-interests of those country level nodes were being subordinated to the interest of the global good, right? The global interest, so to speak. And so I think of this as the nodes rebalancing the harmony within the system. So countries are strengthening their needs, the protection, the safeguarding of their needs and their interests within the context of what they view is the global context. And the trick is to maintain that in balance. So there isn't too much of an exploitative node within an overall system. You can apply that same principle to companies within the context of the markets within which they operate. But to your earlier point, in the past century, when we were hyper-focused, I would say, on productivity, efficiency, and very kind of linear and structured systems, that balancing would fracture in periods of great change. So the pandemic is the example that everybody loves to point to, where global supply chains just absolutely fractured. A lot of things fractured, economies fractured, because they were too structured, too regimented to be able to flux. Back to Vic's point, there wasn't this buffering system and built-in redundancy, adaptation, local accessibility. So I think the ecosystem gives us the freedom to operate with a design that balances the interests of the individual nodes, whether that's an industry, geopolitical context, individuals within society. It's a balancing of the interest and needs of the individual node within the greater system. The key is for the system designers to understand what paradigms need to be set, what guardrails need to be set in order to enable that optimization of the node and the overall system on an ongoing basis. As new technologies come online, as new innovations come online, as emergences and convergences get basically absorbed into those systems. Vic, your thoughts?
I think that's very interesting. And I'm wondering, I guess I have more questions. So I'm wondering how this applies going forward. So we're assuming that past behavior is going to predict what's happening in the future. And a lot of the things that were these buffering kind of functions, you're saying perhaps the nodes are self-organizing, rearranging. And to some extent, I see that happening where, you know, there's these informal groups that form around interests. There are countries that are reorganizing their alliances. There's new trade agreements, like Marco said, that are being formed. There is a new kind of phase that we're entering now, is like the space race. And this is something you're very familiar with, Diane. And there's like a whole range of technological advances happening there. And the old set of rules in terms of this is an open space, we don't really need to regulate it too much or think about it too much, that mindset's kind of shifting. Everyone's trying to lay claim to it. There's the tourism part of it. There's the research part of it. And then there's obviously the commercialization part of it and geopolitics and such. And so when it comes to the different scales of these problems, and then also the different scales of the technologies and products being developed, do you see ecosystems with these, like these emergent properties, being able to tackle a lot of those problems? And I guess you've been working on orchestrating different kinds of technologies across like different maturity speeds and such through your work with the space entrepreneurs and at GE before that. How do you actually see this going forward with space specifically, I guess?
It's basically a great exercise for all of us to kind of lean into, because we've talked about this, but we just naturally bring our own paradigms that we are well established here on Earth. We bring those same paradigms into the way that we are thinking about space, right? And developing and exploring space. So to your point, Vic, we bring the same geopolitical frames. We bring the same industrial kind of development frames, the same societal kind of opportunities, rather than looking at this as a completely blank page, open to new norms, new rules, and new experiences. I think we've learned a lot that we could apply, you know, the lessons learned to the way that we engage for this new horizon. But we don't seem to be doing that, right? So we seem to be thinking about science and research in space the same way that we approach that here on Earth, although some of the assumptions are different. I love the microgravity work that we heard from Lynn Harper and Dan Rasky about. It really shows how you can really set aside the assumptions that we have applied to past research and really kind of approach things with a white page and get incredible outcomes. That is, I think, a lesson that we should all take, whether it's pharma or defense or tourism in that new that new horizon in space, but we have to get comfortable with how we engage in that new palette, if you will. The work that we've done in space has left tremendous fields of debris, and that can hamper the accessibility of what is possible in space. It can hamper the experience and the productivity of space. Yet no one is really taking the lead on owning the sustainability of the environment that we're creating. So we need to think differently as we reach into space, but you know, that path lies ahead of us.
Yeah. I was going to jump in briefly with the following considerations. First of all, just as a reminder to our listeners that, you know, we've been diving into the space economy over the course of the previous seasons. My takeaway is that the space economy is fascinating because it brings up three main issues. One, as you mentioned, Diane, is the acceleration of scientific innovation and product development that can happen in space through microgravity. And so how can we develop new materials, new drugs? This is already happening, as we've heard in previous episodes, it accelerates innovation globally and on Earth. The second is the new competition for things like materials, natural resources, access to solar energy. And the third one is the geopolitical aspect. A lot of security on Earth depends now on the control of weapons systems and communication systems in space. So there are these three elements which we will continue to explore in season 7 and beyond, which make the space economy and space especially interesting. Linked to this, for me, the consideration that comes up and it follows from what you were saying, Diane, is the following. We're looking back at the past 250 years and forward to the next 250. Have we learned anything? Because what's remarkable about the past 250 years, and we've touched on it earlier, is that we've made enormous progress, both in terms of economics and science, but we've done it in a fairly hectic and haphazard way, getting to stages where we thought, oh my God, we've created a huge problem over here. How do we fix it? And even now we're looking at a situation where, from a geopolitical perspective, we've created a mess. And we've avoided wars, but we now have big pieces of the world economy which are completely at odds with each other, completely in conflict. What we've loved to call the rules-based international order of the past 20, 50 years is pretty much broken down. So as now space opens up as a brand new dimension of what we're doing, are we able to look forward 50 years, 100 years, and try to anticipate some of the unintended consequences, the possible mistakes, and maybe move a little bit more slowly, but plan ahead in a way that reduces the risk of getting everything completely messed up again? Or is it inevitable? Is the uncertainty such that there is no other way to move forward but to try, do what we feel like we need to do, and then when the problems arise, we'll fix them?
It's a great point. Just real quickly, and then I'd like to pose that same question to Vic, but thinking back in the past 250 years, and Vic, you had mentioned the work that we did at GE. One of the functions that we led was the development of new markets for some of our financial businesses. And whenever we were exploring basically a new market opportunity, and I say this with Marco, to your point, the horizon of space, or even the horizon of AI, the maturation of AI, the same principles apply. But developing these new horizons at GE, developing new country applications of our financial tools and businesses, we needed to make sure that there was some level of kind of stable expectations. There was infrastructure in place. So we needed to have a pretty good sense for the regulatory environment. We needed to have pretty strong confidence that we could ensure our operations. There was a way to lay off risk. We needed to understand the societal norms within which we would be operating, the regulatory landscape, the ability to lay off risk, the way to harmonize our operations with what was established within that market context. right? So there needed to be some level of predictability. We needed to understand the likely outcomes of the actions that we were going to take within the context of that market. So if we think about applying those same paradigms to the exploration of space, we don't yet have that level of certainty, predictability, and assurance. If we think about the future of AI and, say, quantum, we don't yet understand all the implications. We don't have the ability yet to really lay off, much less understand the risk within which we will be operating and contributing. And so there is much more uncertainty in the path forward. Marco, to your point, do we recalibrate, slow down, and try to understand more of those scenarios? Or do we forge ahead and just assume that we can adapt and overcome the unanticipated circumstances that we might encounter? Vic, I know you do a lot of futures work. Asking you to be our Sherpa, how should we be thinking about all of this change in new kind of new markets with new technologies and with the pace at which these seem to be evolving?
It's a really complex question, Diane, and this goes back to something you were talking about, which is the pace of development. And are we going to repeat what we've done over the last 200 or so years and when we're going out into space, when we're going out exploring AI, quantum, biotech? And it seems like we're on that trajectory. And to your point about futuring, I think there's a growing awareness that we need strategic foresight capabilities and people to start investigating the various scenarios that come about when you combine all of these different technologies and different timescales and inform the public and the government and industry on the risks. In some ways, we're leading with what can we do and how fast can we do it rather than should we be doing it, to your point, Marco. And so there's several concerns here that have to do with, so in terms of economics, there's, you know, what exactly is the viability of a lot of these products? Who is it going to benefit? We're already seeing large, you know, income inequality, wealth inequality globally, and something that has a high barrier to entry, like the space economy, is, from my layperson's point of view, only going to exacerbate those inequalities. And given the condition that we're in right now, where there is, you know, a large populist movement, there's almost like a counter establishment kind of mindset. And typically the world goes through these generational cycles. Every, you know, 3 to 5 generations, there's a building, there's almost like a complacency, a setting up of a counterculture, and then there's a collapse. And this used to happen, you know, locally. Now, obviously, because we're interconnected, there's a tendency for these things to kind of mesh and become more global. And so if we somehow overlap the disconnects with the underlying pattern of the collapse and these new frontiers that are emerging, which are threatening to maybe accelerate a lot of these differences, there's a lot of things to be worried about and a lot of questions to answer. So I think we need to be fostering these discussions like I think we're planning to in this season. So what are the new infections or health risks that will come about through manufacturing medications in space or exposing people to the space environment? When it comes to even the risk of pollution or aesthetic pollution, if you think about it, what is the moon going to look like with a bunch of inflatable hotels that are set up over there? If we start mining, what potential accidents could happen that may change the orbit of the moon and have an impact on tides and wind patterns and ocean currents on the Earth? Now, these may be far away, but these are things that we should probably start thinking about now, because all it takes is one major accident. And the more our technology advances, the bigger the impact is globally. On the other side of it, you mentioned assumptions. And one of the positives here is that if we actually enable a space-based manufacturing capability, we might not need to be constrained by the assumptions we have in terms of like launch capabilities and fairing sizes and, you know, payload cost and things like that. We could actually create a new way of thinking about extraterrestrial economy and society based on what's available in space. So basically an Earth independent mindset. And so what are those thoughts and ethics that go behind that? Can we answer those kinds of questions? So that's what's interesting to me.
There's lots of fascinating things there, and lots of issues that we'll need to explore in the season, especially in what you were saying last, Vic, this idea of anticipating possible problems, breaking away from our long-held assumptions. This is going to be exactly what we hope to get from the luminaries and visionaries we will bring in as guests. I wanted also to link back to something Vic mentioned earlier, which was the issue of wealth concentration. But I wanted to bring it up to highlight what I think is an interesting paradox from our point of view. Now, we've been talking about the importance of ecosystems. Vic, earlier in the conversation today, you were pointing out the importance of a more distributed system because it is more resilient and therefore has a better degree, overall a better degree of efficiency and better survival chances. Now, interestingly enough, though, in this phase of innovation, some of what we are observing is the opposite. Vic, when we were talking offline, you pointed out that the government is effectively subsidizing existing monopolies in technology, especially on the AI research side. This overlays with the geopolitical situation because, of course, all countries now feel like this is an existential race because the stakes are so high. The potential advantage you get if artificial general intelligence really is within grasp, getting to it first has enormous benefits. So to maximize the probability of winning this race, countries seem to be investing in the big companies, in the big winners, instead of creating frameworks for small business incubation. In fact, this concentration of resources is displacing and crowding out the smaller businesses that we could hope to see. So what are your thoughts on this? First of all, is it, like I said, I shouldn't expect answers because this is what we will aim for in the season, but isn't there something very interesting here, which is we are highlighting the benefits of distributed systems, and instead the betting now is all on very concentrated innovation engines in a way that eliminates, wipes out resources for smaller innovators. Is this going to continue? Is this actually going to backfire by slowing innovation? Is there any way to break this vicious circle? What are your thoughts?
Yeah, good question. And again, like you said, I don't have the answers to that, but it would be great to hear from people who are more informed. My preliminary thoughts here are one of the roles that I think governments, nonprofits, and even individuals that care about the future should start to think about is what kind of frameworks to set up such that the development of these kinds of AI tools, agents, and other kinds of advanced software that leverage quantum computing cloud. How can we actually distribute the development of this and democratize not just the development, but also the applications? And so some of this has to do with, and I think we were discussing this before, Marco, is what is the role of an individual in the future economy if we have an AGI? If we have, maybe even companies no longer have relevance. And so if we start to think about how to put that kind of framework around the development of AI, maybe create an ecosystem through whether it's grants or small business programs to target the infrastructure needed, because there's a huge barrier to entry. Not everyone can afford cloud computing and servers and such. The energy usage for these, the LLMs is huge, and especially when people don't really understand how much energy they're using. You can pretty much ask a question and say, I want the response in the form of a Dilbert cartoon or something. And if every human on the planet is doing stuff like that, it's just taking up a tremendous amount of energy. So on the flip side of it, it seems like at least in the US, this isn't everywhere, but in the US, the ability of government to make informed decisions, I think, has been greatly reduced due to scaling back of science, of the people that are responsible for making strategic decisions, employing foresight. And it's almost at the same time as when they're most critically needed. And so that is a bit disconcerting. And this is why I think the onus is now on the general public, on science communicators, on nonprofits and other organizations, even industry in their own self-interest. And I'd like to hear your thoughts on this, Marco. I think it is in the interest of industry to make sure that this plays out correctly, or they're going to find themselves obsolete as well.
It's fascinating because, in fact, on the issue of incentives for industries, there is something that strikes me a paradox within the paradox, if you will, which is the following. We're essentially giving all the resources and giving a free hand to these large companies because we want them to develop artificial general intelligence, and they feel that it's in their interest. And we have this fear that if this happens, then those companies, they have the capital, they have the server farms, and they will have all the power and the economy. And that's where the economic game will end, with an enormous concentration of wealth. But the paradox that strikes me is essentially not true. So say that Meta or OpenAI or Anthropics, somebody develops artificial general intelligence. That's, loosely speaking, a machine that can then produce all the knowledge and the innovation we need. Now, if let's pick on OpenAI, if OpenAI develops that, once that has been developed, I, as a government, don't need OpenAI anymore. So if I am running the country, I'm expropriating the company, because at that point, I don't need to give anybody any incentive to innovate anymore. It's a fascinating issue that I hope we'll be able to explore in the course of the season, that if we go towards a scenario of superintelligence, a lot of economics as we know it breaks down completely, because economics as we know it is based on incentives and scarce resources. That's all going to break down. Now, I don't think we'll get there anytime soon, but it's worth thinking about. More importantly, I think it's worth thinking about the incentives we have today for both bigger and smaller companies, because this is what will drive innovation. And linking back to your question of the interest that companies have on having this work out well, I would say, Vic, that another crucial barrier is going to be the barrier of trust. And that also feeds into technology adoption, right? Because I think there has been an increased interference on the part of government on science, and you alluded to it, Vic, and that is a big problem. I think this is my personal and controversial opinion. I feel that over the last 10, 15 years, science has betrayed the public in many instances. And science together with institutions, together with policymakers. It is a fact that now we face a massive lack of trust. The increased reluctance towards vaccines across the board is just one example. And I think it's in the interest of companies to try to rebuild that trust, both because it's in their own self-interest, but also because otherwise it might become a major obstacle to the fast enough adoption of technology.
I'd love to jump in there too, and Vic, I'll toss it over to you. But I think this is so important, such an important theme for us to chase this season. I know we got after it in our last six seasons, but I think the role of government, at least within our nation, is evolving and needs to evolve further. The definition of what we refer to as infrastructure, historically roads and bridges, now needs to include also concepts like the distribution, the fair and unfettered distribution of information. What are the incentives that are going to drive harmony within the ecosystem? Is security, cybersecurity, education, and to your point, Marco, trust. These elements need to define infrastructure that needs to be safeguarded, maintained, developed in order to carry us forward in this digital and increasingly interconnected society, because we have seen basically throttling of not only science, but I would also argue information has been throttled in ways that have been very, very harmful for different components within society and industry. And those systems of information cannot be compromised, really. In order to achieve and maintain trust in the system and in the nodes within the system, we need to have unfettered and freely accessible flows of information. Incentive, our education system has become compromised or out of date. We need a very robust and high integrity system of education so that the next 250 years are led by a workforce and leaders that have the best information possible in order to provide futures literacy and scenario thinking and complex systems thinking. We've talked in previous seasons about the increase in specialization. We need to maintain that, but we also need systems thinkers. We need thinkers that are futures literate. So we need government's role to evolve to more of an ecosystem orchestrator across complex systems. We need infrastructure that maintains high fidelity flows of information, incentive, security, cybersecurity, education, and trust. And then that will support advancements in science, technology, innovation, and basically societal experience, even if we do see the onset of superintelligence, which may stretch the limits of our lifetimes, but it's on its way, no doubt.
It's something I feel very strongly about. We do need to stress the importance of building up human capital, because right now there is a lot of concern about artificial intelligence displacing humans. And my attitude on this is maybe when it happens, we'll deal with it. But for the time being, we should be very careful not to actually create these incentives to the acquisition of knowledge, skills, and abilities, because it is crucial that we build up the human capital to complement the technological innovation that we're pushing forward. And I hope this is something else that we'll continue to explore and stress in our season.
I 100% agree with that. In addition to the human capital side, you know, in later life stages, you mentioned education, Diane, and I think there are some studies coming out now in terms of cognitive development as it relates to people who are engaging with digital media versus like physical, tangible media, reading versus screens, and how your ability to imagine, how your ability to create connections, context, all of that is negatively impacted, perhaps. And so obviously, I think more research needs to be done on that, but we're essentially setting ourselves up for future generations that maybe in this, you know, artificial general intelligence age, where the AI has the ability to do all of these things that previously humans could do, and we've somehow adapted ourselves to not do those things that made us uniquely human through the technology we've been developing. So yeah, how do we create incentive systems to make sure that we retain our capacities as humans? And yeah, what does it, one of the questions I guess I'm interested in is will we start to talk about, you know, personhood with, you know, AI, and then when will we have the first AI person in space? What does that mean? And so there's so many other things that could show up, like the first maybe president or world leader going to space, or, you know, the safety issues associated with that, the geopolitical risks, all of those kinds of things. So hopefully we'll learn more about all of these things this season.
I'm tempted to reference to the Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. At some point, our hero encounters a spaceship of people who have been specially selected to be the first ones to leave the endangered planet. So then it's another important avenue to explore.
I love it. I think I just heard an invitation for our good President Trump to lead us into space. So maybe Mr. Trump will take us into the next horizon. Really, this has been a fascinating conversation. The hour disappeared quickly. And I sense that the year ahead will pass very quickly with the amazing conversations we'll have. I know we teed up a lot of really complex questions here, and these are not rhetorical questions, as I know our listeners and audience will appreciate. They're basically the roadmap for season 7 and for the next 250 years. For us, a full year of weekly conversations with experts grappling these challenges in space, defense, AI, healthcare, and much more. And America's next 250 years will equally be defined not only by individual platforms or heroic platforms, but by our individual ability to really orchestrate these ecosystems thoughtfully, driving innovation, exploration, operations for elevating the human experience, right, and optimizing performance. So we're going to see systems that learn faster, systems that strengthen through adversity, systems that bridge commercial speed with mission assurance, systems that maintain cohesion amid strategic competition. What we all know is that the future doesn't wait, as DARPA taught us. Imagine it and then drag it into the present. So season 7 is about asking the right questions so we can build the right answers. So again, everyone, thank you for joining us. Marco, Vic, thank you for setting up another amazing season of Ecosystemic Futures. And for our listeners, grab us on Spotify, Apple Podcast, or your favorite podcast source. And you can always find us at shushumworks.com. Marco, Vic, any final thoughts for our listeners?
No, I'm just overwhelmed. So thanks. And we really look forward to explore all these issues with you. I guess I'll say I'm an economist, so I already have all the answers. I had to hold back and not to give spoilers, but I have all the answers. So follow us and you'll find out.
It's up to Marco. Vic, you and I can take the year off.
I agree. Yeah. And we can also lay all the blame on Marco when things go bad. Yes.
Good plan. Vic, your thoughts for our listeners? Final thoughts?
Oh no, same. Looking forward to hearing a lot of the answers. And it would, yeah, if there's any kind of listener engagement, if people want to somehow engage us and tell us what kinds of questions they have and would like to listen to, that would be nice as well.
Great point. And guest speakers, right? So listeners, your homework, if you should choose to accept, bring us the guests that you would like to hear from, and we'll get them on. Everyone, thank you again, and looking for a great year ahead.
Thanks, everyone.
Thanks.